I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It should be no surprise that education in grades K through 12 is becoming increasingly high-tech with computers and tablets, smart boards, PowerPoint, online videos, blogs. Some see these innovations as good tools to improve learning, to personalize education, and for cash-strapped districts to save money. Others question the value of this technology and point to studies that have found that online learning does not necessarily live up to all the hype. But it's here to stay. We're going to talk about how technology is changing education classrooms and the student-teacher relationship. And our guest is Robert Slavin. He's director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University. Bob Slavin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Delighted to be here.
Most schools, I'm assuming, are wired for technology. Is that true?
Yes. I think surveys find that the vast majority of schools have internet access. They have a wide variety of technology now.
And the kinds of technologies that schools are using, what's the range?
Still the most typical are computer-assisted instruction, where kids do drill and practice activities that are self-paced, either in the back of the classroom or in a computer lab. But the rapidly growing applications are things more like interactive whiteboards and other classroom technology that that improves the ability of teachers to teach effective lessons.
And what's an interactive whiteboard?
Well, a smart board is an example, or a Promethean. The smart board is a particular brand of this. But what it means is that there is an electronic board that the teacher can use to present anything that you could put on a computer, but it also creates the possibility that you can write things on it electronically that go into the computer and tap into a vast array of resources to, rather than just tell kids something, show them something, or engage them in some activity that that you want to engage the whole class with.
Now, we're talking about students that have largely grown up with technology. I'm assuming that for students, this is how they learn and do things.
Well, kids learn all different kinds of ways. It certainly is the case that kids are what they call digital natives now. Most kids have an enormous amount of experience playing games and using technology in all sorts of ways. But fundamentally, they still need to learn to read, to write, to do mathematics with and without technology. And technology is just one of many tools that they need to be able to use to learn.
Do kids, and there's often this division between learning and playing. When we're talking about technology, is there technology that kind of bring those two together for students?
Since the first time people were talking about technology back in the 1970s, everybody has talked about, you know, how much fun kids have with technology and computers, and has been searching for the holy grail of, you know, how do you make the fun and the learning go together? And it's not as easy as it seems, because there are different requirements for making something fun and making it educational in the sense of learning a specific thing. So if kids are playing something and they incidentally learn a lot about some particular topic that they want to go into, that does happen. But to say that the school curriculum can all be made fun in that way, it can perhaps, but it's not there yet.
Is it possible to say, do we know enough and have studies found that this kind of learning and teaching results in better achievement, more achievement? Are kids learning more?
I have done some reviews of research on applications of technology in reading and in mathematics in K to 12, and the answer is that the technologies that are in most wide use, particularly the drill and practice individual technologies, are not making much difference in student learning. The studies find some benefits, but the benefits are rather small. And they depend a great deal on the degree to which the materials are actually used. But it's not a huge impact that's been demonstrated for students' learning.
Does that surprise you?
Well, yes. And it's disturbing because there's billions and billions of dollars that are being spent on technology in schools with the expectation that carting in a whole lot of technology will turn things around. And that's just not happening. I do think that there's great promise in technology, and I'm by no means willing to give up on it. But I was surprised how clear the evidence was that the technology applications that we've had for the last 20 years, let's say, has not made that much difference.
Does that mean we need to figure out how to create better drill and practice technologies?
I think the solution probably lies in a different direction. I think that the promising technologies, in my view, and this is not totally supported by research either, but it's supported by some research. My view is that technology is most effective in teaching when it integrates with what the teacher does rather than trying to replace the teacher. So that technologies like interactive whiteboards or smart boards or other things that improve the quality of classroom instruction, that help the teacher to be more effective, that help the teacher to use visual images or to take ongoing assessments of how students are learning from a particular lesson, those are the technologies that I think may be more revolutionary than the ones that send the kids down the hall to work on their own.
Well, that's very interesting. Does that also say that the teachers need better training so that they can use these tools more effectively?
It definitely says that. In a way, technology has been sent down the hall, both figuratively as well as literally. It's something that many, many teachers still don't feel that comfortable with, and they sense, well, send the kids down. They seem to enjoy working on the computers. I don't really care what they're doing on it. It gives me some time to do a little preparation while they're down in the computer lab. But they don't really integrate with what's going on in the computer lab, and it's hard to because all the kids are all doing different things. In a way, what I think the next step is going to be is to bring the technology into the classroom to make it something that the teachers embrace and really understand how to use flexibly and appropriately to improve the quality of their instruction. That's going to take a lot more professional development than the old-fashioned technology lab ever did.
But you know what's so interesting is because all of us use technology in some way, and I would say largely feel our lives have been enhanced by it. It makes things easier. And yet it seems when it comes to education, whatever reform or innovation we're talking about, it seems so hard and so slow to incorporate.
It is true. And it's difficult to reconcile how much technology has changed the rest of life against how little it has changed education. But what happens over very long periods of time is that things happen in life in general, and people say, gosh, that's going to change everything for education. And then nobody really works out how it's going to change things for education. Mm-hmm. As a kid myself, when television was expanding greatly, and everybody was saying, "Oh my gosh, television is going to change everything," because now kids
will remember those days. Yes,
will just watch educational television, and they hardly even need to go to school. The educational television will teach them just fine. And of course, that didn't take place. And I think that you can't count on the idea that just because technology is used in so many other areas that it automatically solves problems of education. A lot of what technology does in regular life, too, to be honest, is making things that we already could do faster or more efficient rather than completely changing. So you could go to an encyclopedia instead of using Google, but it's so much faster to use Google.
Right.
You could make calls on a telephone instead of a cell phone, but a cell phone can do them so much more than what an ordinary telephone could do. And in education, technology is being used to make things more efficient and faster and well organized and so on. But really getting into the core of instruction, It's not made fundamental changes as I think it could, but certainly has not to this date.
Do we still need textbooks? And by that I mean, you know, tactile textbooks that students hold in their hand when the internet exists in all its forms out there?
I personally believe that the textbook, particularly in subjects like math and science, is a goner.
Is a goner.
Yeah. Again, not necessarily because the internet or because electronic textbooks are better, but because the physical textbook is expensive. And I think that, you know, right now you've got California and other states that are trying to move away from textbooks purely on a financial basis, much less because they think it's going to be more effective. And I think that the cost issue is going to put people in a very different space. I think that they'll still maintain reading books for elementary kids, you know, that are tactile. But for the areas where you're looking for examples or your kids are working problems, it's easy to just flash things up on a whiteboard and have kids work problems from there, or to have something on the equivalent of an iPad or, you know, other electronic forms that simply are less expensive and more efficient. And I think that things will go that way fairly rapidly, just because of the cost savings.
Well, I was wondering about that, whether districts are looking at this technology purely in cost-saving terms.
I think initially that attracts school districts, but what's going to start happening, I believe, is that as soon as the textbook starts to fade away just on a cost basis, it's going to occur to people that you could make a much better textbook. If you had it electronic, you could have a textbook that responds, for example, to the patterns of answers that the kids are making, or that could show visual media, or could be interactive, or have games, or could have any number of ways of using, for example, hyperlinks, so that if kids get interested in a particular point, they could click on something and then get to more information on it, rather than just having a linear text the way the initial electronic textbooks are just taking the linear text and putting it on in an electronic form. But that's, I think, going to be swept away very soon, where people will make things that are more appropriate to the way people use technology and make a textbook that may be a better textbook.
Let's take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Robert Slavin is our guest. He's the director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University. We are talking about how technology is changing education, not necessarily for the better, but certainly lots of potential there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'd be interested in your questions and your comments. And we have Salman Khan waiting in the wings, a director, executive director, and founder of Khan Academy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater and the Philadelphia premiere of Microcrisis, a scathing new satire about Wall Street, using the Nobel Prize-winning concept of microcredit to ravage the world economy. Telling the rapid-fire story of a slick, big-vision banker and his gaggle of innocent do-gooders, Microcrisis takes a humorously panoramic view of global finance as the banker and his unwitting accomplices try desperately to stay one step ahead of the game. Tickets and information at interacttheater.org.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
Eddie, it's cold outside, and you know what that means?
WHYY's winter membership drive is just around the corner.
You'd probably rather sit by the fire with Steve Inskeep instead of us.
And you can when you take advantage of YStream.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to radio programs without pledge breaks.
For all the details, including special discounts for current members, visit whyy.org/YStream. Moorestown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, January 22nd at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates can be found online at mfsopportunities.org. mfsopportunities.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about how technology is changing education, schoolrooms, and teaching. Our guest is Robert Slavin from Johns Hopkins University. And joining us now is Salman Khan. He's the founder and executive director of Khan Academy, and that's a free online education site with thousands of videos and practice exercises covering everything from arithmetic to physics, finance, and history. He began this online service for some young cousins who needed some math tutorials. And Salman Khan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And I know this goes back to, 2006, and you had a cousin that needed some tutorial help?
Yeah, the first tutoring I did of my cousins was in 2004, and then in 2006 was when I first made some of the videos.
And the idea was, which grew out of the help that you were providing for your cousin in 2004, what was the idea behind the videos?
Yeah, you know, I was tutoring one cousin in 2004, and then I started tutoring her brothers and a bunch of other cousins, and I had a day job, so it got a little hard for me to scale myself, and I actually started writing some software to give them problems and for me to track things. But I was having trouble scaling the actual tutorials, and a buddy said, "Hey, why don't you record some videos and put them on YouTube?" And you know, I was a little dismissive. I said, "You know, that's for cats playing piano, not serious mathematics." But you know, I gave it a shot, and you know, as I joke now, my cousin said that they like me better on YouTube than in person.
Indeed. Well, I was looking at some of the videos over the weekend, and this is not meant as an insult in any way. These are kind of low-tech. I mean, we don't see you, but we see you doing problems and explaining mathematical concepts, things like that.
Yeah, no, in a lot of ways, I mean, they're using, I guess, modern technology, but they're kind of traditional in that they really do, I think, feel, and this is how people have described them to me, like we're sitting down at the kitchen table and working through something. And then, exactly, you don't see me. You see kind of the piece of paper. It's a digital piece of paper, but we're working through it. I use some different colors and things, but you hear my voice, and it does feel like we're next to each other.
And I mean, do you think of yourself as a good explainer?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. But people, it seems to have resonated with people out there.
Let me get Bob Slavin back in on the conversation. I don't know if you've been to Khan Academy, Bob, or not.
I have.
You have. What do you make of it?
I think it's terrific, and it's an excellent example of different use of technology to solve a number of problems that a textbook is just never going to solve. The great majority of kids just don't get it from a textbook, and sending them home and saying, spend more time with the textbook is just not useful. And so particularly for kids who need a supplement to what the teacher does or have missed a lesson or just didn't get something, I think it's a fabulous resource.
And Salman, you also have ability for people to, I guess, for students to track their own progress online as well.
Yeah, that's actually where most of our resources are going to. We have a pretty large software development team, and it's also branching off from some of that stuff that I did for my cousins before even the first video, and this idea of, when I was tutoring them, I just had this general sense that they just had a lot of gaps in their knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in seventh grade, but they were missing skills in second or third grade, and there was no way for them to kind of fill those gaps. And so it was a little kind of quizzing software at first, but now it's gotten a good bit more advanced. But it's exactly that. It gives people problems at their level. It moves them up once they've shown proficiency or mastery in something, and then it keeps all the data and statistics so that a teacher or a parent or even the student themselves sees exactly where they are, and it can notify a teacher or a parent, hey, you should intervene now because they seem to be stuck on negative exponents.
And has this been incorporated into school districts?
Yeah, we're not for profit. We got our first real funding about 18 months ago, and right after that, a local school district in here in California, the Los Altos School District, which actually probably I think it is the top school district in California, they were interested. Said, "What would you do with a fifth grade class?" And we said, "Oh, look, we'd have every student working at their own pace on something like this. They'd come to class and tutor each other, and the teacher could walk around and intervene when it's most needed. And they were game. So we started a pilot last year in 2 fifth-grade classes and actually 2 remedial math classes in 7th grade. And the results were very good, especially in the 7th-grade classes. It doubled the number of kids at grade level. 6% of the remedial students were now advanced. So just looking at that data, they decided to go full district this year. And now we're also piloting with several charter schools in this area, public, private, just to kind of see all of the different use cases.
That is clearly impressive. What do you think explains those results?
I think, I think especially in the 7th-grade class, it was a remedial math class, they were supposed to be taught pre-algebra, but we saw firsthand, especially when they were working on the problems, we could look at the data and we could say, wow, some of these kids don't know their multiplication tables. And, if you don't know your multiplication tables, you might be innately smart, and even that's coming to question, what does it even mean to be innately smart? But you could be very motivated and smart, and you have a great teacher, but if you don't know your multiplication tables, there's no way to address that in a traditional 7th-grade class. But now these students could. They could go back, do multiplication, do decimals, whatever they needed, and it was different for every kid. And then progress. And a few kids who did get things, they were able to race ahead. Even though it was a remedial math class, they weren't held back.
Now, Bob Slavin, okay, so here's an example of a successful program in a school district in California. And the impulse is to say, okay, let's take this and use it across the country. Does that work?
I think that, first off, there are lots of things that you could do with Khan Academy, and I think you'd want to crystallize a particular application that you'd want to test out. So, is it being used just to fill gaps for kids as a supplement to what they're doing? Is it being used as an alternative to what teachers are ordinarily doing? And then once you did that, and it wouldn't be too difficult, then you'd have to do a much larger and more controlled experiment. We do need to have clear evaluations. There are lots and lots and lots of things that people have been enthusiastic about that have gone across the country and then found out to be not terribly effective. Personally, I think the Khan Academy idea is very good and would work out in a study of that kind, but it's way too early from the evidence base to be rolling it out across the country based on a small pilot.
Going back to you, Salman Khan, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation. I was reading about the flip the classroom, and I guess this is what's being used in the Los Altos School District. Can you just explain that so our listeners know what that means?
Yeah, and also I completely agree that I don't think it would be healthy even to do a forced rollout to the entire country. I think it's very important, especially at this stage in your organization, to do very controlled pilots, really understand what's happening, and it's helping us iterate on the product itself. But the flip classroom, it's funny because I actually mentioned that halfway through a TED talk about what we're doing, and this actually happened before even we got funding and we had built out the software. I was mentioning, hey, look, these videos were on YouTube, and I started getting letters from teachers saying, hey, you've given the lecture on least common multiple or L'Hopital's rule. I now have my students watch that at home at their own time and pace. They can pause, repeat, they can remediate, not feel embarrassed. And then they come to class, and that's where they do what would traditionally have been homework. So they do problem solving. And what's good about that is now you're in an environment where you can actually get help from the teacher, the peers. The teacher can actually see in real time how everyone's doing. I sometimes take a little pause saying that we are about the classroom, because I kind of view that as that is an improvement, because now you're making class time interactive and people are able to get lectures on what they need. But I think that the next step is to even break the mold of every student working at their own pace, and people should really work on what they're ready for. And so that's, we want to go the flip to the next level where every, students master concepts, move on. Everyone is expected to kind of have a high level of mastery, and the variable is how long they have to learn it.
Bob Slavin, what do you think of the idea of kids watching these lectures at home and then doing the work at their own pace, bringing it in to classroom for discussion with the other students or for help from the teacher?
Could work, but I think you'd have to put it to the test, and you'd have to work out. There'd be a lot of stuff to work out to make that work in a broad scale of in a broad set of schools. But I think in principle it could be done, and it could be a very productive use of technology. One of the things that's really going to be a breakthrough in fairly near term is the ubiquity of technological capacity at home. Once a teacher can count on the idea that not 25 out of 25 kids, I mean not 20 out of 25, but 25 out of 25 kids have access to powerful technology at home, then the home environment becomes useful in a way that it is not useful right now.
And that's Bob Slavin, director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University. Also with us is Salman Khan. He's the founder and executive director of Khan Academy. And we've been talking about the free online education site. It has many, many videos and practice exercises covering everything from arithmetic to physics, finance, and history. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, talking about technology in the classroom. Let's see what Edwin from Medford has to say. Edwin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
This is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. I've worked in education for 15 to 16 years now. I'm a former teacher and a building technology coordinator, and I think one of the defining moments of this topic was after giving a professional development to my staff, having them raise their hands at the end of the session, asking who was going to implement the technology. It was a visual mapping tool that I'm sure that the speakers know called the Kidspiration and Inspiration, and not one hand went up.
Mm.
And so that led me to do a lot of research in my master's program on the integration and the adoption of technology. And I'd like to get the speaker's thoughts on this. And some of my research showed me that teachers who taught in more traditional ways were a lot less likely to adopt technology because they couldn't control the flow of information. And those teachers that were more constructivist in nature, where students construct their own knowledge socially or with from some other source, were more likely to adopt technology. And it also showed the difference on how technology was taught to the teachers. If it was taught in a constructivist manner, teachers would be more likely to adopt it in a constructivist manner.
Well, you know what, Evan, let me take your point, and I think it raises an interesting several interesting questions about teachers and their willingness to embrace and use and understand this technology. Bob Slavin, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think it's raises the caller raises some very important points. You cannot underestimate the requirements for professional development for teachers to really make effective use of these technology tools. There are many, many, many teachers, even in the most well-equipped and technology-oriented schools and districts, who can hardly press the on button and are terrified of the technology. And then others who are doing fabulous things. When a teacher, when you go visit a school and a principal walks you down the hall and takes you in to see, you know, teachers who are making incredibly effective use of technology, you say, "Oh my gosh, this is the future! This is fabulous! These kids are turned on! This is wonderful!" And then while the principal's not looking, you sneak to the next class, and there's not a bit of technology ever on in that class. You can see that whatever computer there is has got books stacked on top of it and has never been used. We cannot underestimate what's going to be required to really have technology be front and center in every one of our classrooms, even in individual schools and districts, much less across the country.
And Salman Khan, thinking about this school district in California, have you found similar things?
Yeah, and I agree with both comments. When we started it last year, it was a relatively small pilot with five teachers, and they volunteered to do it, and they really were these, superstar, and all the teachers have been quite impressive, but these guys just, knocked it out of the park. And so even the results we saw, to a large degree, could have been just because these were superstar teachers. This year, it's a much broader pilot, the entire district, and we are seeing some of what the other two commenters described. There's sometimes a little bit more resistance. What we found is that most of the teachers actually do embrace they embrace the ideas of it. They love the idea of being able to differentiate, of students being able to master concepts. But it is hard. If you spent the last 15, 20 years kind of giving lectures and not kind of doing problem solving within classroom, it's hard to transition. And some of these teachers are very good at what they were doing, but it is a major shift. And I think some of what Bob's alluding to, I think, the technology is it can do much more than just kind of supercharge an existing classroom. I think it allows you to rethink what a classroom even looks like. If every student's working at their own pace, do you have to separate them by age groups? Do you have to have these rooms that can fit 30 people that all have line of sight to the chalkboard? Can you have larger rooms that with more teachers in the room and everyone's interacting with each other?
Let me get, and thanks for the call, Edwin. We've got, looks like Lud from Voorhees to join us on Radio Times. Lud, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Marty. Just a couple of comments about the use of technology in the classroom. I think there's a more radical use of technology that I haven't heard your guest discuss, and it has to do, it focuses around the notion of personalization and a kind of a deep and long-lasting database record, in effect, for each student on an individualized basis, which also tracks in a school setting the strengths and weaknesses of each teacher. And the idea would be that the record would be would continue in the life of the student, presumably with ownership of the student and his parents, so that he can actually transfer it from school setting to school setting. But essentially what it is a surrogate teacher that is tracking the experience, the psychological state, the learning and teaching learning abilities of in each of the course areas for each student, thereby creating individualization and personalization in the classroom setting, so that a teacher can then be directed to provide individual attention in conjunction with the student over certain course materials. And of course, there's an array of course materials that are coming out.
Well,
but
let me take that point, because it's a good one, and I want to give Salman Khan a chance to weigh in on that before we have to say goodbye to him. Salman, do you like this idea?
Yeah, no, I mean, he described about 60% of our features over the next few months. No, but a lot of that, you know, that's one of the reasons Los Altos also like it. Now they have this narrative. A teacher can look, and it's like looking at someone's medical records. They can look at and the student, exactly as the speaker said, has ownership over it and can decide who to share that with. But they can see their narrative since they started with the software, and they have this rich data that can trigger, that can say, hey, you should work with this student, or this student works better in this way or that way. We can cater the content to the student, and then we can also use that data to iterate and improve the content. So for us, the most exciting thing about it is that we have a platform. There's 4 million students using it regularly now, and we can use that data to iterate on it and make it better.
You see that potential, Bob Slavin?
I do. I think that the information is useful, but the key question then is, what does the teacher do on the basis of that? The teacher trying to manage completely different instructional approaches for 25 or 30 different kids may not be able to use this information very effectively, and I think that you may need to think of more radical ways of restructuring what teachers do to make that kind of information optimally useful.
Well, everything comes back to the teacher, of course, and I do want to pick up on that after this short break. But first, Salman Khan, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I had great fun at Khan Academy over the weekend. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Founder, Executive Director of Khan Academy, Bob Slavin, staying with us for the rest of the hour. Bob is Director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University. We are talking about computers and tablets, electronic whiteboards, PowerPoint, increasingly being used in classrooms across the country. Are they improving education, or have they been oversold and underused? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Approximately 12,000 new cases of invasive cervical cancer will be diagnosed this year in the U.S. Because early cervical cancers or precancers often have no signs or symptoms, the Pap test is the gold standard for screening. Catching this cancer early often leads to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
Since 1980, no Republican has won the party's presidential nomination without a victory in South Carolina. This year, there's a tough battle to block Mitt Romney's path to the nomination. I'm Audie Cornish. On Saturday, January 21st, NPR News will bring you up-to-the-minute results, reaction from the campaigns, and expert analysis. Live coverage of the South Carolina primary from NPR News.
Saturday night at 7 on WHYY. Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Donald Margulies' drama Time Stand Still, now through February 5th. Sarah and James, a photojournalist and a foreign correspondent, have a partnership based on telling the toughest stories and, together, making a difference. But when their own story takes a sudden turn, the adventurous couple confronts the prospect of a more conventional life. Directed by Bud Martin in co-production with Act 2 Playhouse. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We increasingly rely on computers and technology to run our lives, so why not education? We're talking about how technology is changing education. Bob Slavin, our guest, talking to us about what does and doesn't work. He's at Johns Hopkins University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Connie from, looks like, Germantown to join our conversation. And Connie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm an instructional designer, and I've been working in this field for, 30 years or so. And I've also taught in public schools. And while I work with adults now, I'll tell you that what I've always found is the same between children and adults. It's that the emotional connection with what you're learning, the presence of the teacher caring about what you're learning, is so important. We're not just intellectual learners. It's not just the body of content that has to be poured out of a machine into a brain. It is also the sort of emotional reception of the learner that I have always found has been important. And that's the thing that technology can take out of learning. So I'm fully agreeing with Mr. Slavin that the teacher using technology and integrating it into what the child feels like or the adult feels like, care that they learn, and then they start caring.
And
so that's a comment, and also would you please comment on that aspect? Thank you.
Connie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bob Slavin, go ahead.
I wish I could get a tape of your comment. That is so right and so misunderstood. People talk about technology as though you can, you know, turn on the computer and turn off the teacher and everything's going to be fine. But think about what an actual student, an actual child is really like. Do they learn because they're trying to get a better job someday or because they want to get a better score or because, you know, something like that? They do not. They learn because they want to please somebody who is valuable to them. They make an emotional connection with a teacher. And by the way, we also are big proponents of cooperative learning and using technology in connection with cooperative learning because kids make emotional connections to each other. I think getting kids' hearts engaged with their learning and their technology, as well as their minds engaged, is going to be essential, and that's going to mean human-to-human connection, not just human-to-computer connection.
Because learning is good learning, real learning, and achievement is in many ways about that student-teacher relationship.
No question. And that's what kids are about. They are emotional beings. They learn because they're satisfying something in themselves that has to do with their emotions, their self-esteem, their connections with peers, as well as with the teacher. And for technology to ignore that, then technology itself will be ignored. When technology takes that into account, then I think technology will become central.
But if you don't have a particularly good teacher, can technology make up the difference?
Nothing can repair a horrible teacher, but I think that many, many teachers can be given assists with technology to make more effective use of their time and to be better organized and to present more visual content and to remind them about use of effective strategies. One of the things that we do in a project that we have is using electronic whiteboards and showing the kids examples of things in mathematics, and we've also done this in writing and in reading, but showing kids examples of things that should be going on in their own classroom, such as cooperative learning, and then
it becomes impossible for the teacher to say, no, we're not doing cooperative learning this week. And it becomes impossible for the kids or the teachers to say, we don't really know what this is supposed to look like, because they see it over and over again. And using technology to cue effective practices and exciting content and well-organized and effective material that's not technology in itself, I think is maybe a way to really get the benefits from both sides, both the benefits of what teachers bring as well as the benefits of what technology brings.
Because I'm assuming if you're talking about cooperative learning, there's social networking, yes?
It could be social networking, but no technology has to be involved in that. That just could be kids to kids.
Right.
But it could be that in the sequence of activities that a teacher might be using, then there's an indicator that says, now it's time for your cooperative learning activity, or perhaps that would show an example with little kids of puppets doing a cooperative learning activity, or with older kids of kids doing a cooperative learning activity that models what the kids are going to do. And then that just builds effective practices into the daily routine of what the teacher does. And the technology can enhance that and can make it just routine for teachers rather than having them struggle with trying to figure out what comes next or maintain, be sure that each and every lesson contains a wide variety of effective strategies.
Let me see what Toby from Elkton, Maryland has to say. Toby, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, and thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is really how technology is actually used in the classroom. Just background, I've worked as a substitute teacher in Delaware schools, and when I've been substituting for an inclusion teacher and the regular teachers in the room, students sit down at the computers to do their drilling and practicing on geometry, say, and if they pay attention to the first half hour, then they get to play arcade games for the last 20 minutes as a reward. And it just seems like a waste of this technology. And then when you walk around the room, some of the kids are, say, doing geometry, and they don't have the skills to write down the problem of, you know, how do you find the perimeter of a square or something. They just go through the program so many times that they say, oh, the purple one with the 11, I think the answer is 44. And it's not in their bones. It's not physical. And I just don't know how a sixth grader can learn that with a mouse if they don't already know it somehow.
Well, that's very interesting, Toby. Let me see what Robert Slavin says.
I think that the kind of use of computers that you're describing is the overwhelming use that's made right now, and that's what the research is finding not to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that just too often kids are turned over to using technology in just that kind of way. The instruction that the kids are getting is very minimal. The kid, you know, teacher may come over and look over the shoulder and give a little bit of commentary, but they're not getting an adequate explanation just from the computer itself, and it doesn't work. It doesn't take advantage of what I think computers could do, but have not been asked to do until fairly recently.
Anything wrong with rewarding kids with a couple minutes of a video game?
No, I think that's fine. But I think that it's in the first of all, you don't need 20 minutes to do that. I mean, that's a huge waste of instructional time.
Right.
But it's fine to have some kind of system that rewards the kids for the work that they're doing. But if the work that they're doing is not meaningful work, if it's not anything that really moves them forward in understanding the content, then rewarding them for doing it doesn't get you very far ahead.
Toby, thanks for the call. Let's see what Jim from Morrisville has to say. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Barney. Hi, everybody.
Hi there.
I guess I want to talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the corner is funding. My wife is an elementary school teacher. We're paying for her master's degree loans right now. I have two kids in elementary school. I'd love to see them have technology at their fingertips in the classroom. I'd love to see smart boards. I'd love to see it. But the reality of it is, Who's number one? Who's paying for the technology? Because right now, across the country, the whole attitude of people is really to cut funding, and school boards are doing just that everywhere. And then, who's going to pay for all these teachers to be trained? I mean, you talk about the teachers that have 15, 20 years; they all need to be trained. And who's going to pay for that? And I think it's a big problem. But, you know, there's a computer lab in each of my kids' schools, and I think that's what the last caller was referring to, the substitute teacher, when the kids go to the lab. But I think your experts are talking about incorporating it more into the classroom, not just in the specials. And where's the funding for that going to come from? I'll listen to your comments off the air, but thank you for your time.
Jim, thanks for the call. Bob, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. Obviously, in the current environment, funding is critical, and actually, in any environment, it's an important question. But right now, in the East Coast, we spend about $10,000 per kid per year, on average, to educate kids. If you could get better outcomes for $10,100 or $10,200, of course you'd want to do it. I'm not saying that it would be easy to find the $100 or $200. It may be that you could have better, you know, efficiencies of one kind or another that makes it so that it doesn't cost anything at all more than what we're spending. But I think it's foolish when we're spending so much on the buildings, the teachers, the basics that everybody would want to be adequate in every school, to not look for ways to improve the outcomes, whether it be by use of technology or use of professional development or whatever else it might be. We do need to be conservative, though, in using our scarce resources on things that we know to be effective, and not throw money into things that look cute or that are popular right now or faddish, but really focus on things that have been proven and known to be effective.
Let me ask about online schools. There's a study I'm looking at, actually an article that was in the New York Times earlier this month, a study by the National Education Policy Center, finding that about 27% of privately managed online schools achieved adequate yearly progress on standardized tests, well below those students who were in brick-and-mortar charter schools. What explains that difference, you think?
I don't know. Remember, a lot of the kids who go to who would participate in online schools are kids who have serious problems, that's why they're in online schools. You know, they may have been expelled, they may be having interpersonal difficulties, they may be having academic difficulties, and so I don't think it's fair just to look at those numbers and say, well, that proves that the online schools are ineffective. But on the other hand, I would sure like to see proper evaluations of that kind of instruction, because it's fair. If in fact you found out that it was detrimental, even taking into account the particular kids who are participating in it, then I would hope that that policies would work against them.
Let me get Sean from looks like East Falls to join our conversation. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I taught in an alternative high school where we had every student, 15 students in a classroom, all using their own computer for all the subjects, language arts, science, math, etc. And the experience I had was one of the teaching experience being more intense, and it's a challenge that makes me say I think there need to be more teachers in a classroom with students, because you not only need to know the subject matter, but you got to know the screens that different students are going to be on when they're working through the material, and you've got to make sure that, as one of the other callers said, that emotional connection is still there. There's so much going on. It's so much more intense. I wonder how this can be done without having more teachers in the room, because otherwise teachers are going to burn out.
Well, that's very interesting, Sean. Bob Slavin, what do you think?
I think it's not sensible to create systems that require superhuman individuals. I think, you know, I have the greatest respect for teachers, and I love great teachers trying to do things in difficult circumstances like the ones that you're describing. But if the technology is requiring a lot more from the teacher than an ordinary teacher can possibly do, then it may not be the best thing to be using. I think that we have to be looking at the practicality of using technology or any other strategy, whether it's a technology strategy or anything else. We need to look at the effectiveness of the thing, the cost of it, and the you know, the practicality to use it at scale, and not just assume that because everybody's into technology that this is the right thing to do.
Is there a school district that you think is onto something?
I wouldn't name one compared to another. I think that it's hard to separate. When Sal Khan was talking about Los Altos, this is one of the wealthiest districts in the middle of Silicon Valley. You know, to say that they're showing great results, they may very well be, and that may be something from which everybody needs to learn. But it's hard to just look at the outcomes that school districts are getting outside of a proper experimental versus control kind of experiment that makes sure that you're comparing apples to apples.
And we're almost out of time here. So what do you think is the top priority? Do we need more research, more training for teachers? What's next?
I think we need more development of alternative models that are in line with the kinds of technologies that are available now. We need very careful evaluation of a wide range of applications that are different from the applications that we've had in the past. And we need to then start paying attention to those evaluations and trying to expand use of programs and practices that do have good evidence and back away from things that are perhaps not so effective.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
I've enjoyed it.
Me as well. And that's Robert Slavin, director of the Center for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University. We also talked with Salman Khan, founder and executive director of Khan Academy. And we had many phone calls. We always do when we talk about education. You can go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter and email and the archives. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.